Less than 2 hours later, as Wraith's squadron was skirting Kominov for the first leg of the course, the squad's communications expert, Jesmin Akbar, transmitted,
"Wraith leader, this is true. I have transmissions on an Imperial channel."
Kel knew that Jesmin, who was the niece of the famous Mon Calamari admiral, had an upgraded communications and sensor package in her X-Wing. Jesmin continued,
"Its origin is pretty close to our flight path from Kominov. Either they are waiting there for us, or they're using Kovinor as a backstop for the signal, so it won't reach Folor."
Kel thought fast. Kominor's government dealt and traded with the New Republic, with the shrinking empire, even with warlords. So, if the incoming vessel or vessels were transmitting to Kominor, they were either announcing their arrival or making requests of the government. "Four, this is Five." Grinder's voice came back.
"I hear you, Five."
"In all the time you've been here, have you sliced into Kominor's official computer system?" Grinder was slow in responding.
"Yes, Five, just to keep in practice."
"Good. Slice in now. Look for any new mobilizations of government forces, new reservations for ship berths. Also, I want astronomical data, if possible, from any observatories pointed out toward the origin of Jesmin's signal." They waited in silence for a few minutes.
"Five, this is Four. Orbital Space Yard 301 has been ordered to clear a servicing berth for private yacht Implacable."
Wedge's voice cut in.
"Five, Four, this is Leader. Implacable is an Imperial Star Destroyer commanded by Admiral Triggett. Good work, you two. We're going back to Folor, and we're going to set up a greeting for Admiral Triggett that he's going to remember for a while. Form up on me."
Admiral Triggett beamed as he viewed the moon through the bridge's transparisteel windows. An ugly, mountainous, frost-coated thing, it was well positioned to be of considerable use to the rebels. He'd put an end to that. An aide appeared beside him.
"Sir, we have low-level beacon transmissions and encrypted transmissions on rebel frequencies from the far side of the moon."
Triggett nodded. "Pinpoint the transmissions, then set a course for that location. Launch the Thai squadrons at 1,000 kilometers to target." Wraith Squadron sat on an icy field between two hill ridges about 10 kilometers from Folor Base. They'd landed with each group of four snub fighters 100 meters apart, arranged in a triangle. Kel decided against another unnecessary check of his power levels and weapons readiness. His right leg was getting twitchy, a sign of his growing nervousness.
"No sign of defensive measures, Admiral."
The Implacable was 100 clicks from the target.
"We'll just have to lure them out," Triggett said amiably. "Dispatch the bomber squadron and a screen of fighters."
Triggett looked at his sensor screen. The Folor base site was littered with craters. The one or two sets of buildings he could make out seemed to be burning. Doubtless they were fuel or chemical depots. Otherwise, they could not burn in the vacuum around Folor. "Any communications from them?"
"No, sir. Their beacons are still transmitting, but they haven't responded to our hails."
"Commence bombardment."
Why did the matter of the surface fuel stations bother him?
Ah, yes.
Kominor's files on the abandoned mining facilities on the moon mentioned numerous surface buildings. The plane Triggett viewed was almost entirely clear of such construction. Obviously, the rebels had destroyed or concealed the ruins in order to make it harder to find the base. A sensible measure, yet more work than the shorthanded rebels were typically capable of performing. Nor was it sensible for them to allow surface refueling depots to remain. His sensors officer looked up at him from the crew pit.
"Sir, I'm reading launch of a Gallo-free medium transport. It's on the other side of Folor, sir."
Triggett slammed his fists down on the arms of his command chair. "A simple trick. Plant beacons and false buildings far from the true base location. Light them up when trouble is spotted. He'd let the rebels make a fool of him. Navigator, set course for the coordinates Lieutenant Petrofell will give you. Get us there as quickly as possible." Wedge heard Jesmin Akbar's voice.
"Commander, confirm Implacable and escorts oncoming by the most direct course."
If I remember Fuller's geography right, Wedge responded, a straight polar shot from the false base to the real one has to bring the invaders across some portion of the pig trough. Let's send a unit of spotters out to confirm their arrival, have them power down so they won't show up on routine scans. When the ties reach the trench, we pop out and chew them up. Kell and Runt maneuvered through a few minutes of wall-hugging corners and precision turns through the pig trough to their observation point. Although a single slip could put him against the side of the fissure and kill him instantly, Kell knew no fear now. It was just him and his fighter against the challenge of speed and obstacle. If he fouled up, if he died, Runt would take that as a warning, slow down fractionally, reach the observation site alive. No one was really depending on him. And that was the way he liked it. They guided their X-Wing smoothly along a jagged cliff face, clearing its top by a mere 2 meters, and set down 20 meters from the drop-off, immediately cutting all power. For a few minutes, they didn't speak. Then Runt said,
I have them!
A moment later, Kell's screen brightened with a jittery view of numerous tiny glows, TIE fighters far to the north. Kell fed the data to 13, his R2 unit, and received the precise map coordinates at the point the fighters would cross, and the exact time of their arrival there. Kell encrypted and transmitted the information, a short burst aimed directly at Folor Base. 4 minutes until the ties reached the pig trough. Then he heard Runt again.
This ties. I have the Star Destroyer.
Kell checked his sensors, saw the blip moving in along the wake of the TIE fighter several minutes back. The signal wouldn't be that strong if they didn't already have their shields up. Kell couldn't let go of the idea of hindering or diverting the massive vessel. What would turn a Star Destroyer away from its mission? A greater perceived threat? A greater prize? He sat upright. Race 4, do you have any of the older encryption codes?
This is 4. I've got a whole string of them.
Good. Here's what we do. Leading the other 9 members of Wraith Squadron through the fissure, Wedge glanced above the rim of the cliff, and just as Kell had calculated, he saw the first of their targets, an oncoming wave of enemy fighters mere seconds from passing overhead. Strike foils to attack position. Wraiths, hit the interceptors first if there are any, then bombers if possible. Follow me in. Wedge cleared the lip of the fissure wall by only a few meters, pleased to see his roommate, Jasmine Akbar, still with him. Wedge realized that the Wraiths were very lucky to have her. It seemed that despite the fact that she had graduated first in her class and had exhibited exceptional flying and communication skills, commanders were reluctant to post her in the fighter unit for which she applied, for fear of being blamed by her famous uncle for any injury she might suffer. Above and ahead, less than 2 clicks away, were 6 full squadrons of TIEs. They faced 3-1 odds. This was going to be bad. He homed in on the squadron of interceptors, or squints, and swept his targeting brackets across them. The brackets went red, and he fired, sending a proton torpedo toward them. More Wraiths fired their torps. Wedge saw no less than 4 interceptors flare out of existence from that first barrage. 3 TIE fighters dove toward them, firing continuously. Wedge closed with them, half rolling his fighter back and forth to present a more confusing profile, and switched to lasers. The shot melted and tore away the entire starboard side of the fighter, sending its severed wing in a plummet toward the lunar surface. Wedge saw a quad pattern of laser fire hit the starboard fighter, coring it through the center of the cockpit. The third pilot panicked, rolled out to begin his escape, and presented the Wraiths with a beautiful side shot. Both linked sets of lasers hit it, melting it to slag in the brief instant before its twin ion engines lost integrity and detonated. Wedge and Jesmond wheeled around, seeking the area where the interceptors were most likely to be. Then across his comm came the last thing he expected to hear.
Huh? Can't you coax any more speed out of that pile of junk?
The voices Admiral Triggett heard coming from the target designated Folor 3 were crackling and full of mechanical buzz. A female voice was saying,
"Hans can't come to the cockpit right now, Rogue 2. He's up to his armpits and what's left of the main engines. We've got only repulsor lifts running."
"Princess, repulsor lifts, I'm going to get you off Folor.
If you can't get those engines up in a couple of minutes, go to ground and hide out. We'll try to come back for you."
Triggett drew his sleeve across his brow to wipe away the sweat that had suddenly appeared there. Han Solo and Leia Organa here? "Pilot, close with target designated Folor 3. We're going to capture some famous rebels." Wedge realized his mouth was hanging open. The Millennium Falcon? Han, Leia, and Rogue Squadron here? It made no sense. Then he caught sight of the information scrolling across his data screen. These transmissions had been encrypted in a code they'd been instructed to abandon weeks ago when they learned the Warlord Zinj's forces had cracked it. Despite the voice distortion, Wedge thought he caught some of Kel Tanner's vocal mannerisms in the voice of Leia and Rogue Two. It was some sort of ploy.
"Leader, Two, Implacable is breaking off."
The sensor screen showed Jesmyn to be correct. The Imperial Star Destroyer was turning slowly to the west, away from the fighter engagement. Wedge smiled broadly. "Race, this is Leader. We've been given some extra time. Make the most of it." Engines wailing, they dove into the thickest of the dogfight, firing as fast as their targeting computers showed green. Implacable gained on them with frightening speed. Kel switched back to the old encryption. "Falcon, sorry, you're on your own. Go to ground, get to cover."
"I read you, Rogue Two. Be strong in the Force. Falcon out."
That was their bug-out signal. Kel instructed 13 to cut the power boost to the X-Wing's transponder and shields. Runt would be doing the same. This would drop the signal strength to that appropriate to a pair of X-Wings instead of two groups of them. If this all worked, a presumed Millennium Falcon and 6 or 8 X-Wings would magically transform on the implacable sensors to a mere 2 fighters. Triggett's sensors officer looked confused. "The signal changed. I think they're trying to jam us. They've gone into that prominent canyon formation." Triggett tapped the point where their southern course would intercept the fissure.
"Pilot, new course, due south. Weapons, prepare the tractor. We'll pluck them out of that ravine like a Gamorrean plucks morts."
The Implacable slowed to a full stop with its main tractor array poised over the fissure. The sensor officer immediately spoke up. "Two ships incoming along that geographical formation, but they're not target Folor 3.
Triggett frowned. "What do you mean? Who are they?"
"Two X-Wings. No Corellian YT-1300s.
No Millennium Falcon."
Triggett closed his eyes. Twice. He'd been fooled twice in one day. He rubbed his forehead at the headache that had suddenly appeared there.
"Maximum laser bombardment. I want them dead."
The first blast hit the fissure wall less than 100 meters ahead of Kel, filling the fissure and sky above with blinding light and melting stone debris. He headed to starboard of the blast sensor, flying by memory while his sight and sensors were useless. He cleared the blast field, only to run right into another one. He heard stone shards hammer against his cockpit, against the side of his fighter. "Six, we're in trouble."
"Five, I'm taking it."
It was Runt's voice, but different. Neither the polite Runt of ordinary conversation, nor the inarticulate screamer who did his best flying. Kel saw Runt overtake him, could barely pick him out visually and by sensor.
"Follow me in. This is an easy one."
Obligingly, Kel brought his fighter up on Runt's wing. Each debris cloud they cleared brought them into another one, but Kel maneuvered when Runt did, and miraculously they avoided tearing themselves to shreds on the fissure walls. Then a sharp right turn, and they were beyond the bombardment.
"Great work, Six," Kel said. "Who was that?"
"The student. The one who remembers,"
who studies for tests. Tell him he just scored very high. Along with the Lambda-class shuttle Nara, the Wraith left Folor for their original destination, Doldrums. Kel found he couldn't extinguish his jubilation. In his first combat mission as a pilot, he hadn't so much as fired a shot at an enemy, but he'd executed tactics that might have saved some of his fellow Wraiths from death under the guns of the Implacable. 13 beeped at him. His timer counted down one standard minute until arrival in the Zobon system, the uninhabited first stop on their route to Doldrums. A bright flash of light rocked Kel's snub fighter. A shower of sparks erupted from his main monitor, and there was smoke in the cockpit. His vision and the viewports cleared, but his instruments were dead, and there was no hiss of air to indicate his life support systems were functioning. Kel depressed a red button behind him until he heard the comforting, familiar whine of a snub fighter trying to bring itself back online. Immediately, words appeared on his data screen. R2-D609 is active. How may I serve you? Kel frowned. R2-D609, what's your name? The R2 unit beeped irritably at this simple test. I am R2-D609. Damn it. 13's memory was gone. It had returned to the default settings burned permanently into its circuits. Within the next couple of minutes, most of the Wraiths had reported in with electronics system damage. Some of it was trivial, but several engines and a couple of astromechs were not coming online. That meant their nav course to Doldrums had been erased. Even a return to Kominor system was impossible. The X-Wings were running close to dry. They didn't even have enough fuel to go looking for a safe landing zone in another system. Wedge doggedly worked through their options, then said, All right, Wraiths. 2 reports a planet and satellites not far away. I'm pretty sure it's Zobom 6, the outermost planet of the system. And it has an atmosphere warm enough for us to effect some repairs. And an asteroid ring. Just the thing if we're being pursued. And I'll bet my Endor patch that we are. We'll transit there, with the Nara towing the 3 non-functional fighters with its pilot retrieval tractor. 5... Get to the shuttle and put on vacuum maintenance suits. You and our chief mechanic, Cubber Dane, will effect the best repairs you can. Then, broadcasting only to Kel's comm, Wedge said, Demolitions. What do you think hit us?
Nothing I've ever heard of. But I think it's some kind of ion bomb that detects hyperspace arrivals, puts out a gravitational pulse to bring them out of hyperspace prematurely, and then hits them with both an ion pulse and electromagnetic pulse.
Ah, said Wedge. So, whoever did this just had to set up their bomb on the path from Kominor to Zobom's sun, the way our nav course took us, and they'd be sure of bagging their target. Meaning that someone knew or suspected there would be traffic from Kominor to Zobom.
Yes, sir. It had to have been planted by the forces that attacked us. They suspected we'd flee by way of Zobom.
Kel had had a little training in zero-G hard vacuum work. In the cumbersome vacuum maintenance suit, which had built-in maneuvering jets, he could move around and stay warm. But he and Cubber didn't have tools rated to the cold of space, just toolboxes cobbled together from the X-Wing hangar back on Folor. And this left them cursing over frozen and vapor-locked hydro spanners. Still, he could look down past his feet to see the world of Zobom 6. Rotating with a slow majesty. Somewhere down there, most of the Wraiths were trying to make repairs to their own less damaged X-Wings. They were probably looking up now and envying Kel his comparatively warm environment suit.
Kel.
The voice was flat, eerie.
It's Min. I need your help.
Go ahead.
Shiner's down. I need him to be up.
We have more important problems right now. Shiner can wait.
Please, Kel.
Kel frowned, troubled. The pain and worry in Donis' voice carried even over the comlink distortion. Try switching the restraining bolt to power down and then switch it back on.
No, it's not. Hey, it is working. Thanks, Tater.
Cubber summed it up.
Commander, we've gotten the rest of the squad mobile in record time, but Finan's X-Wing is a loss until we can get it into a full-shot setup.
Within his cockpit, Finan looked pale. It was evident some of his cybernetics were malfunctioning. Wedge's voice sounded resigned.
All right, pop the hatch and get him into the shuttle. Don't forget his medical gear. In the meantime, we can assume that the bomb that stuck us here also sent out a signal to whoever planted it, meaning they'll be coming soon.
Wedge heard Face's voice.
Leader, this is 8. I say we leave 7's X-Wing up in orbit for them to find, and when they pull it in, we board and seize them.
Ha, thanks much, 8. Anyone else?
Sir, I'm serious. We leave the fighter in orbit, broadcasting a distress signal. And among some debris we leave around it, we could have someone in one of the extra vehicle suits carrying Donus's laser rifle.
And they draw the suit in, and the pilot inside starts shooting.
Yes, sir.
And they do this even when their sensors say there's a live body in the suit? Kel keyed his microphone.
Sir, we could put our intruder in the Nara's smuggling compartment. Its systems will conceal the presence of a living person. We can pull it out of the shuttle and float it among debris.
Face cut back in.
Could we mount a propulsion unit to the compartment? The thrusters from an ejection seat?
Kel said.
Yes.
Wedge took a long time to answer.
Face? Kel? That's the craziest idea I've heard in a long time.
Face said.
Maybe, sir. But we can do this.
Cubber and Tainer towed Nara's smuggling compartment into space and saw where their plan couldn't succeed.
That's not big enough,
Cubber said.
With all the thrusters and life support, the vacuum suit will be too bulky to fit into the compartment.
Kel sighed. Well, our intruder will just have to wear a standard pilot suit.
Our intruder will freeze to death.
Piggy's harshly mechanical voice cut in.
I should be the intruder.
Why is that? Kel asked.
Physical structure, Kel. I am a Gamorrean. My body is swathed in heavy layers of fat that will insulate me from cold temperatures much longer than a human could stand.
In his cockpit, watching the universe spin around the asteroid on which he'd landed, Wedge relaxed with the calm of the seasoned New Republic pilot. The Wraith's X-Wings, as repaired as they could be during their stay on the ground, now rested on some of the planet's larger asteroid satellites in power-down mode. The Nara waited with power up, ready to go, with Piggy standing by in the airlock. Fainan's X-Wing, some stony debris retrieved from the asteroid ring, and the vehicle jury-rigged from the storage compartment and dubbed the Lunatic, spun lazily. At one end of the compartment was Fainan's R2 unit gadget. Mounted at the other end were the fuel pods and some of the thrust nozzles from Fainan's ejection seat. A data cable ran from one of Gadget's ports to the data pad that now held Grinder and Piggy's maneuvering program. Another cable ran to the 6-foot-long cylinder that was what remained of one of Fainan's laser cannons. The X-Wing's comm system continuously broadcast a distress signal recorded by Face. Wedge's comm unit popped.
Nara, this is 5.
Go ahead, 5,
said Cubber.
Cubber, do you remember some sort of attachment mounted toward the aft end of 7's cargo bay when it came in?
No, none of the X-Wings have anything like that.
Well, one of them did. It was about 25 centimeters long.
Wait, hold on.
A long silence, then Cubber came back on.
Something's wrong, kid. The supply officer noticed an attachment like that at the bottom of the main drive unit of the Nara while he was loading it up with the pilot's personal gear on Folor.
Wedge started to request that one of the X-Wings ease out of the asteroids and make a visual check of Nara's aft end, but before he could speak, his wingmate's voice came in.
Wraith, this is true. I have faint chatter on Imperial frequencies.
So, Wedge said something else. Nara, this is Wraith Leader. Place your package, then scram back to one of the big rocks and power down. Piggy, good luck. The Nara drifted to within a few meters of the insertion vehicle. The shuttle's airlock opened, and Piggy pulled himself out, shoved himself off from the airlock, drifted over to the vehicle, and squeezed in. Wedge breathed out a sigh. Now it was all in Piggy's hands. Piggy patted his flight suit, assuring himself that his blaster and the one Grinder had given him were still tucked away there, that the suit's seal was still intact. Then a message appeared on the lunatic's control datapad. Movement detected. The screen switched to a crude monochrome graphic of the stars. A tiny white dot moved across the star field and slowly began to grow. It was a Corellian corvette. Through the crude imager of the datapad, Piggy could see a bright vertical slit of light appear as the hold doors were opened. Two large silhouettes emerged and rapidly grew as they came closer. They resolved themselves into TIE fighters. The two starfighters roared past Fainan's X-Wing and its debris cloud, then looped back for a close view of the X-Wing. Piggy magnified the image of the corvette on his datapad screen, focusing in on the open bow hold, and queried Gadget.
What's our range to target?
300 meters.
Can we make that?
If we make no mistakes, we can. Piggy took a deep breath, then brought up the targeting brackets Grinder had added to his cobbled-together flight program. He set the brackets in the center of the open bow hold and hit the execute button. Piggy was banged up, down, and sideways by thruster corrections. Then gravity had him, and he was standing on his head. He had heard Gadget screech, meaning they had to be within atmosphere. He popped the seal on his pilot suit and dragged out one of his blasters. Then he kicked open the hatch of the smuggling compartment. Bright light flowed in to blind him. He was on his back on a metal floor. It was a miniature hangar space. Two gigantic metal racks held TIE fighters upright. He was almost directly beneath one of them. Forward was the open hold door framing the planet Zobom 6. Piggy rolled over onto his belly, dragging the chopped-down laser cannon out of the compartment after him, and aimed the blaster pistol. Above was a gray catwalk. On it were men in mechanics overalls running toward an exit, and two men in standard stormtrooper armor, aiming rifles his way. He snap-fired at one, hitting the wall behind the trooper. Then he crawled backwards under the cover offered by the nearest TIE fighter. Tactics. The stormtroopers would be separating on the catwalk, moving in either direction to bracket him with fire. He half-stood and put his shoulder against the TIE fighter's wing. The sturdy starfighter resisted his efforts, but some of the brackets holding it in place broke. The TIE rotated, and suddenly he could see the rightmost stormtrooper. The trooper fired at him, but the TIE fighter's solar wing, which Piggy held before him like a shield, absorbed the bolt. Piggy returned fire. So the trooper collapsed to the catwalk. He continued pushing against the wing, rotating the eyeball, firing as he went until the second stormtrooper stumbled forward over the rail. A moment's breather. The hold crewmen had all escaped through the door. There was also the open hold door leading to space. These were the only ways out. Tactics. If he were the ship's captain, he'd shut the internal door and turn off the MagCon field, venting the bay's atmosphere into space and suffocating Piggy, or launching him into the void. Well, he'd have to do something about that. Wedge saw the lunatic shoot into the open bay door. I'll be damned, they did it. He hit his comm key. Attention, TIE fighter pilots. This is Commander Wedge Antilles of the New Republic. We have you under our guns. Surrender or be vaped. The two TIE fighters ceased drifting. One came up to speed, heading toward the corvette, and the other spun back toward Fainan's X-Wing. That eyeball fired. Its green laser shredding the derelict snub fighter. Wedge grimaced. Amateurs. Race, open fire. The fighter approaching the corvette was hit by two quad-link bursts. The one that had destroyed Fainan's craft was hit by three. Both exploded. With the chopped-down laser cannon hanging from its power cable, Piggy climbed the TIE fighter's landing brackets.
At the top of the brackets, he was only a meter from the hold ceiling. He pointed the cannon at the ceiling, averted his eyes, and fired. The light produced by the shot was overwhelming, and the noise was a shriek of metal in displaced air. Melting metal scraps fell all around Figgy, and on him, burning through his pilot suit. He ignored the pain as he clambered atop the bracket beams and leaped up through the hole he'd made into the bridge. Around him, lying on the floor, running toward the exit, reaching toward holsters for blasters they'd never grasped, were the members of the bridge crew. Figgy shouted,
"Stop where you are! One move, and I fire!"
The officers glanced at one another and raised their hands. Only when ash began to drift down from the ceiling did Figgy look up to see what was left of another of the ship's officers. Inconvenient as the planet's weather was, they brought the Corvette Nightcrawler down to the surface of Zobone 6 to perform their examination. The remains that had once been a man named Captain Zural Darillion had fallen free from the ceiling during the ship's landing and dropped into the TIE fighter hold. Phelan, unperturbed by their grisly nature, was dealing with them. Kel and Cubber battled the fierce winds of Zobon 6 to check out the strange device implanted on Inara. From the main weapons console, Jansen called to Wedge on the bridge. "They've souped this Corvette up quite a bit. For instance, they've given up one of their turbolaser cannons and installed a tractor beam instead."
"Most ships this size have a tractor."
Jansen grinned. "I mean a real tractor beam. Something suited to a frigate or larger war vessel." Grinder, bent over one of the bridge's data consoles, called,
"Oh, Commander."
"Yes."
"Figgy got to the bridge so fast they didn't even have time to shut down, to purge ship memory, to activate the most basic security. They didn't even get a distress message off."
Wedge blinked at him.
"Whatever fleet it came from is unaware it's in trouble."
"Exactly. I pulled up its mission profile, its standing orders, its schedule, everything."
"Tell me."
"It belongs to Zinj, but it's temporarily assigned to Admiral Apwar Trigit. From what I can tell from these records, Zinj has far-reaching business interests in a number of unaligned systems. Nightcrawler's mission is to lay Empion mines, and also to visit unaligned planetary systems, demonstrating that Zinj has muscle. It looks like Zinj offers them protection in exchange for their cooperation."
Wedge whistled as the first elements of a plan began to percolate in his mind. While Phelan and Runt guarded 50-plus ship's officers and crewmen, the rest assembled in the small meeting room that was part of the captain's quarters. After thanking everyone for their work, Wedge asked,
"Cubber, Kel, did you find the attachment on the Nara?"
Kel nodded. "Yes. Its memory was blown out like our systems, but I think it was some sort of parasitic communications device. It was mobile. It probably went from ship to ship and broadcast its current location to its maker."
Grinder said, "Which is nothing if there's only one of them, but they could build a map of anomalous hits and find all sorts of things. Smuggler's bases, deep space assembly points."
Wedge said, "Jason, add that to the report we're sending to command. All ships be advised."
"Understood."
Wedge checked the next item on his list.
"All right. We've faked up a report in Captain Darillion's name, explaining that he jumped into this system, found the abandoned X-Wing, assumed that the pilot had ejected, sent over a party to retrieve it, and it blew up. Some nasty treachery on the part of its original pilot. After a few hours' rest, we launch."
Kel said, "Doldrums, here we come."
"No, Tena, not doldrums. We're going to Zartun."
Kel frowned, confused.
"If I may ask, sir..."
"Why this schedule?"
"Because that's the order of business for Nightcrawler. Ladies and gentlemen, we've just become crew members in Warlord Zinj's fleet, and we're going to do his bidding."
"Do his bidding?" But
Phelan was stunned.
"We must keep to Nightcrawler's schedule, or risk raising suspicions,"
Wedge explained.
"We'll make the arranged visits, find out as much as possible about each planet's operations and alliance to Zinj. Then, in the case of those that really are allied to the warlord, we'll put our commando skills to use to, shall I say, decrease their value. Nightcaller seemed eerily quiet. Heading toward the bridge, Kel heard voices drifting down a stairwell to port and followed them up. Seated in the ship's main communications bay were Jasmine, Face, and another man, a hologram, actually. The man, thin, clean-shaven, with hawk-like features, was dressed in a black uniform with Imperial captain's bars, and was given to theatrical gestures as he spoke.
"We have been charged," he said, "with weaving the net that will capture any rebels who are so fortunate as to survive the destruction of the base on Fulor and flee."
The wraiths burst out in laughter. Jasmine hit a button on the main console, and the captain's image froze there. "What is this?" Kel asked. Face leaned back and stretched. "That's our former sealing decoration, Captain Zural Derillion. He apparently kept the ship's log in full hollow." Jasmine turned toward Kel.
"I thought that since Face was an actor, he should see this man's performance. I have seldom seen anything so florid, so self-satisfied, so repellent."
"Oh, I have," Face said. "I once sat on Isani Isard's lap."
Kel said, "You're kidding."
"Oh, no, I'm not. Win or Die had just been released empire-wide. I played a little boy, a son of two patricians of the Old Republic. I'd die in the Emperor's arms, begging him to finish conquering the galaxy so that the evil of people like my parents can be eradicated." Face grinned. "That was the old propaganda machine. So I got a trip to Imperial Center. I saw Isane Isard, and she sat me in her lap and told me what a good boy I was. Captain Darillion is nothing in comparison." Kel suggested some changes be made on the Corvette and ended up pulling a succession of shifts while he and Cubber implemented them. They emptied the ball-shaped escape pods and wedge-docked the two remaining TIE fighters in them. The end result was that from any scrutiny except close examination, the fighters looked like escape pods, and in time of need would actually be faster and safer to launch than out of the bow hold. With the TIE fighters out of the hold, X-Wings could use repulsor lifts to back into the hold and could get instructions from ground control to slide into rails that Kel and Cover spaced to accommodate their strike foils. This gave them an array of 3 X-Wings by 3. The ones in the center column could launch most quickly. Kel cackled and rubbed his hands together. More than a squadron's worth by virtue of superior engineering.
"Not bad. Not bad at all," Wedge had to agree. "Nightcrawlers, ready for action."
"Captain Darillion and the Warlord will be very pleased," Face said. His entire face was covered in a sheath of flesh-tone polymer that allowed his skin to breathe yet concealed his true features. He wore an Imperial Lieutenant's uniform modified to bear the extravagant rank insignia unique to Nightcrawler. The man before him, Nojin Kolb, governor of the outer rim world of Zartun, smiled in appreciation.
"I am delighted to hear it."
In the sky, the first of Zartun's 2 suns was just beginning to rise over the innocuous bunker, where Face, posing as Darillion's assistant, had just spent a couple of informative hours. The governor had given him a comprehensive tour. Face had seen an impressive array of transparasteel products, such as blast-proof windows and fighter canopies. All of it, the governor explained, now owned by Lord Houghton Wheen, a name which, after some searching in Nightcrawler's files, turned out to be an alias of Warlord Zinge.
"All right, Wraiths, we've had the facts on what we found," Wedge leaned forward. "Now, I want some speculation. What is Zinge up to?"
It was the day after the commando strike, and the Wraiths, now parsecs from the Zartun system, were debriefing in Nightcrawler's conference room.
"This is just a guess," Grinder said, "but it looks to me like they're setting up a financial empire to support Zinge's ambitions."
Kel nodded. "I also think he's doing it to support Iron Fist, his superstar destroyer. Here, he makes replacement transparent steel parts. At another place, he refines fuel. Wedge shook his head. They're using the hit-and-run tactics we perfected, operating from secret bases. My guess is that Zinge is compartmentalizing information about himself, structuring his holdings in cells, probably contacting each cell using a different pseudonym. Like a resistance movement, so that information is contained. It's odd. In a sense, we're becoming the Empire, and warlords like Zinge are becoming the Alliance. We've become a legitimate government with fixed locations we have to reinforce and protect. At Belthu, the next world on Nightcaller's circuit, the chairman of a mining company privately let the disguised face know that a shipment of refined durasteel awaited the arrival of Zinge's next bulk cargo hauler. 2 days later, the foundry went up in smoke. The next stop was not a settled world. In fact, the planetary system had only a number designation, M2398. Jesmyn picked up trace communications indicating that the place might be a pirate's nest, with outposts on a moon and an asteroid belt. From his seat in the comm center, Face watched the monitor and prepared to pose as Darillion, should the smugglers make contact. The deceptive techniques the Wraiths were using had become very sophisticated. Grinder had used his slicing skills to create a holographic overlay, using the personal journal and ship's log that the egotistical Captain Darillion had kept in full hollow. From the huge sampling available to him, Grinder had compiled a computer model of Darillion's body from the waist up, and had generated his voice into an overlay, both of which could be projected over Face. The result was near-instantaneous translation of sight and sound. As long as the fake Darillion didn't have to meet anyone in person, and as long as Face could bluff his way through situations where the enemy knew more than the Wraiths did, they figured they could keep up the ploy. Almost immediately, the comm board lit up as the unseen parties out there began communicating.
Looks like it's Captain Dundee. This is Bloodness, Darillion. I told you not to come back.
Face snorted. I recall you requesting me not to come back. Do you remember us talking about the possibility of mutual profit? Face was guessing now, presuming that Darillion had followed what seemed to be his predictable pattern in dealing with these people. Have you really decided to close off all my avenues to more wealth, more power?
No, of course not. Very well. I'm clearing you to land on Berth 2.
Eventually, the moon of Bloodnest came into view. A large and dismal brown thing. Wedge, designated as Grey 1, and Phelan, Grey 2, settled into the cockpit restraints of Nightcaller's TIE fighters as gravity began to pull the corvette. There were no seas below, only pockmarked brown and red desert. The corvette passed above it, heading toward high mountains in the distance. As they approached the first set of foothills, Wedge saw a curved portion of ground below the corvette curl up and retract. A laser artillery cannon, its barrel elevating straight toward the unshielded keel of Nightcaller. Bridge, bring up all shields. Grey 2, launch. Follow my lead. Fire at will. Phelan launched and skimmed after Wedge toward the moon's surface. He suited action to words, firing as soon as his laser cannons oriented on the artillery unit below. From over the comm came the voice of Chode Hreknes, Nightcaller's newly appointed captain. Hreknes and his second-in-command, an elegant woman from Coruscant, Lieutenant Atril Taban, along with several crew members, had been provided during a brief rendezvous with a New Republic shuttle to which Nightcaller's prisoners had been transferred. Captain Hreknes' voice was cool.
Wraiths, Greys, we have incoming from dead ahead.